This is John Hockenberry. Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway, produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. We'd love for you to be a part of the conversation. Find and friend us at Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and there's more at thetakeaway.org. Here we go. Hope you enjoy the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And in the wake of the September 11th, 2001 attacks in the U.S., there were well-intentioned questions about why do they hate us? America's lack of understanding of the they, of the then unfamiliar Al-Qaeda terrorists, was combined with a sense of mystery about any possible why. What we all discovered was that there had been a secret or at least poorly understood war going on against Al-Qaeda for years before 2001. History may be repeating itself, reacting to the State Department advisory for all U.S. personnel to leave Yemen, warnings that a terrorist attack there may be imminent, the unprecedented closing of 22 U.S. facilities, including embassies. Americans might honestly ask, why Yemen? And what we are learning or being reminded of this week is that the U.S., along with the Yemeni government, has been conducting a shooting war inside Yemen for years. Seven dead today in drone strikes in the south of the country. Yemen also claimed today that it foiled an Al-Qaeda plot to blow up gas facilities and take over key cities. In the past 4 years, the U.S. has bombarded Yemen with at least 75 strikes, some by planes and ships, many by drones, targeting AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The death toll from these attacks is estimated to be at least 600. At the same time, AQAP has steadily attracted more members. In 2009, the group had 300 members, it was estimated. Today, it has over 1,000. Is this policy working? Well, Faria al-Muslimi, a Yemeni activist who testified before Congress last April, warned, no, it's not, unless the intent of the U.S. is to make Yemenis terrified about the United States.
But when they think of America, they think of the terror they feel from the drones that hover over their heads, ready to fire missiles at any time. What a violent militants had previously failed to achieve, one drone strike accomplished in an instant.
Yemen, U.S. policy, and this well-established war zone in Yemen is the subject of Our World, Yemen, America's new front line, which airs later this week on the BBC. BBC reporter Yalda Hakim joins me now from London. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me, John.
So you say America's next front line, but in fact, this has been a front line, at least for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, for quite a while, and the U.S. has been involved for quite a while.
Indeed, it has. There's no doubt that Yemen has become the front line for the war against Al-Qaeda for the United States. Between 2011 and 2012, the drone strikes have tripled in Yemen, and 2012 saw the highest number of drones used in Yemen than anywhere else in the world. I went deep into Al-Qaeda territory in the south of the country, where I wanted to understand what it was like for people living with the constant sound of drones overhead, and also meet a number of people who say that they've been directly affected by the drone strikes because family members have been killed. And, you know, earlier you said, you quoted the statement, why do they hate us? I think a lot of them, what they told me is, we don't hate America. You know, for years and decades, America has been good to us. They've offered us, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in aid. But none of this is now being seen because it's being overshadowed by the U.S. counterterrorism policy in the country. Yemenis have traveled to the United States to study. A lot of them have brought those skills back to Yemen, just as the terrorist Anwar al-Awlaki did and his father Nasser al-Awlaki did in the United States. So it's not this attitude that they hate America, but what happens when these strikes do occur? It's not that they're naturally sympathetic towards Al-Qaeda, but when the strikes happen, they become anti-American.
Well, indeed, and that's the sentiment of Faria al-Muslimi, who testified before Congress. His village was bombed, even though he had had a very, very generous experience in the United States, and the experience of his village being bombed made him very, very bitter about all that. Yet the government has a very different view. Here's Yemeni Foreign Minister Abu Bakr al-Kirbi.
The fact is that if your targets are Al-Qaeda leaders, and if they are endangering the security of your country, there is no alternative but to get at these individuals.
Yalda Hakim, does the Yemeni government believe it's fighting for its own survival?
I think so. I mean, it's a very fragile government. We mustn't forget that the Yemenis had their own Arab revolution a few years ago where they overthrew a dictator of 30 years. But the situation remains fragile. The country is, dealing with corruption. The economy is in a mess. There's a huge situation where we're seeing a fragile government and the situation is deteriorating in the country. And what that does is create a haven and a power vacuum for these terrorists to come in and use it as a base. So I do think in many ways they are fighting for their survival. But having said that, I think, what we need to understand about Yemen is it's different to a place like Iraq, for example. It's a very tribal society. It operates on tribal lines. So, sometimes when the United States is given intelligence about a potential militant operating in an area, we've heard reports that it actually could come down to tribal war. It's not actually a militant as such, but it's someone wanting to get someone back. But when I asked the Yemeni foreign minister about Yemen's sovereignty, and I said a lot of people are angry because they think, this is putting Yemen's sovereignty at stake. He said it would be putting our sovereignty at question if we weren't approving these strikes, and every single strike is being approved by the Yemeni government.
Well, the question of exploiting U.S. military capability for sort of tribal vendettas is an experience America should know very well in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The question of survival for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula does not seem to be a question. However, you mentioned Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed in a drone strike, the insurgent, the anti-American insurgent. You spoke with his father, Nasser al-Awlaki, and here's what he had to say.
Even if he made some of those sermons, which could be classified as hate sermons, I don't think that's right for the United States to go and kill him. If there are any allegations against my son, the United States government could have done something else, going to court. But they did not do that. They went ahead and killed him. There were maybe 300 people who were in Al-Qaeda. Now we are talking about thousands of people.
Do you think, Yalda Hakim, that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is thriving amidst this war?
Absolutely. I think that they're taking full advantage of the United States' counterterrorism policy in their country. If anything, al-Qaeda doesn't want these drones to stop, because what they're doing is when, for example, civilians are killed, apparently al-Qaeda is then stepping in, paying compensation to the families, offering to pay compensation, paying for funeral costs, and then pressuring these locals to join al-Qaeda to take revenge. So they may lose a few militants here and there in some drone strikes, but then they're recruiting so many more as a result. So I think that it's actually working to their benefit.
Yalda Hakim is a BBC World News correspondent. She's a reporter behind the new documentary Yemen, America's New Front Line, which airs later this week on the BBC. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So let's set all this in context with Gregory Johnson, who's the author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. He's a PhD candidate in the Near Eastern Studies Department at Princeton University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there's a lot going on here. Would you say that an imminent attack in Yemen would be the first and foremost message of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, we are alive and well? Or does it relate to this al-Zawahiri message of wanting to react to the abduction of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt? There's a lot going on here in the region.
Right. That's absolutely correct, John. I think what we're seeing is that Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda's global network, is putting a lot of pressure on an individual named Nasser al-Wahashi. This is the head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And what Ayman al-Zawahiri wants is for the group in Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, to carry out an attack as soon as possible. And I think that's what is driving some of these embassy closures, some of this threat alert. But that isn't necessarily new. This is something that when Osama bin Laden was alive, he often did with different branches of al-Qaeda. He would press them to carry out attacks. And often the individuals on the ground, the men in place, people like Nasser al-Wahashi in Yemen, would resist a little bit, saying they weren't ready.
And it's interesting to me, and I wonder if you could react to this. Here's Jen Psaki, who's a State Department spokeswoman, really attempting to downplay the question of all of these warnings and whether they have anything to do with the larger relationship between the U.S. and Yemen.
This was a decision related to a specific immediate threat That's why we made the decision, but it doesn't have an impact, or we don't see it having an impact on our larger relationship.
So she suggests there that there is something completely sustainable about this war in Yemen and the U.S. relationship with Yemen. Do you believe that's the case?
Well, that's interesting that you play that clip from the State Department spokesperson, because just yesterday, when the U.S. was evacuating people from Yemen, the Yemen Foreign Ministry put out a statement condemning that evacuation and saying this evacuation, sending Americans home, is something that actually helps the terrorists. And so there's a different view whether you're in Washington or whether you're in Sana'a, in the capital of Yemen, on this.
Now, I remember during the Arab Spring focus, when Yemen was in such turmoil, that there was a lot of discussion that really who was driving the situation in Yemen was the Saudis, who have their own mission of maintaining security on their Yemeni border. They have their own beef with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and that the U.S. is really acting as the kind of military arm of Saudi Arabia here. How do you see it?
Yeah, that's a great point, John. I think what really the Achilles heel for the United States in a place like Yemen is that it just does not have very good human intelligence on the ground. And what that means is that the United States is then forced to rely upon people like Saudi Arabia or the Yemeni government, who often have different agendas than does the United States. So the U.S. in Yemen is primarily concerned with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Saudi Arabia and the Yemeni government are certainly concerned with al-Qaeda, but they have a number of other concerns that the U.S. might not necessarily share. So the U.S. has great technology. The drones can be a powerful weapon, but they're a dependent piece of technology. They need to know what it is to hit, and that information comes from human intelligence on the ground, and this is where the United States is particularly weak.
Finally, we've been led to believe that the situation in Iraq is on a downturn, that the U.S. is ending its relationship in Iraq, ending its relationship in Afghanistan. Those war fronts seem to be relatively stable, incapable of producing unexpected headlines. What's the situation in Yemen? Is that trend line on the upswing in terms of U.S. involvement, or is it just simply unstable and capable of all kinds of events that we can't anticipate right now?
Right. So just last night, we saw a drone strike. 2 nights ago, we saw a drone strike. Last week, we saw 3 drone strikes. The U.S. is clearly carrying out a number of strikes within Yemen. It's very, very eager to sort of take the fight to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in the hopes that they can fire enough missiles into Yemen that they can keep al-Qaeda back on their heels so they can't sort of plot, plan, and launch attacks from Yemen against the United States. But there's a bit of a problem with this. And basically, in a war like this, the war that the U.S. is in Yemen, the side that kills the most civilians loses. And this is something that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has internalized in its attacks in Yemen. This is not something that the U.S. appears to have internalized or at least realized and learned from its past mistakes. And so I fear the U.S. is headed down a very dangerous road in a place like Yemen.
Gregory Johnson is the author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. He's a PhD candidate in the Near Eastern Studies Department at Princeton University. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Later this hour, could fast food be a possible cure, not a cause of obesity? It certainly does bring happiness to some of you, like Carly in Philadelphia.
My go-to fast food guilty pleasure is the filet of fish with fries and a Coke from McDonald's. Grossly delicious.
Tell us your fast food nirvana at 877-8-MY-TAKE. In our look this week at the implications of PTSD on returning soldiers, on the stresses of war and deployments, on military families, we can't ignore the feelings of an enthusiastic, charming little 9-year-old boy named MJ, who suddenly finds himself in a dark, sad place when he's asked about what he gives up every time he says goodbye to his dad.
I have to say bye to my dad and allow him to leave. And when he's gone, he misses my Boy Scout when I became a Weeblo.
Because of his deployments to Iraq, MJ Greentree's Navy dad, Mike, missed his son getting his Scouting Weeblos badge. It's an experience of absence that young MJ carries with him from all the moving around of being a military kid. He tries to convince me that it's become easy for him to be the new kid in class at school.
For me, it just, like, comes naturally to be the new kid.
Consider the courage of young MJ now, who came into our studios with his mom, Vivian, all ready to explain what it's like to hold down the fort all the time while his father is gone, and he ends up overcome with emotions he can't control. PTSD is like that, intruding unexpectedly, emotions bursting forth. Now, MJ Greentree is not diagnosed with PTSD, neither is his dad, Mike, but his family is part of the collective American experience of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, where a fifth of the 2 million-plus combat veterans from those wars has some symptoms of PTSD. Last year alone, 349 military personnel committed suicide, close to one a day, a number that easily outpaced the number of combat deaths in Afghanistan last year. Advocate Vivian Greentree, she's also MJ's mom, is caught in the middle of all this. She's director of research and policy for Blue Star Families, an organization she helped found in 2008. Part of her mission, she says, is to help military families watch for warning signs that someone, soldier, spouse, or child, is in trouble emotionally.
Families are at the really the epicenter for the service members, and that's whether it's a spouse or a partner, a sibling, their children, their parents. So involving them in the process and teaching them to recognize the signs when a service member or a veteran does show signs of distress, setting up expectations that are realistic, talking openly and communicating in positive ways. Those aren't things that people know inherently, and it's something that the military community are interested in building those skill sets within our families.
In your family, when does the stress begin in a deployment, and how does it enter your day as you deal
when
with
I'm asleep.
What? Go ahead, just
yeah, right. It's when does it start? The one thing that I hold at the very basic for me is that I know that how children cope, the single determinant that shows itself is whether the at-home caregiving parent is coping well, because the kids take their cues from you. You know, we know that extracurricular activities are good for children during deployments because it keeps them active. The problem with that is, of course, you have one less parent to help get them there. So sometimes that can fall by the wayside, and then you deal with the guilt of, well, I couldn't get to both of their events, and if, you know, I'm in school or I have a job or I can't do all that. And then that starts like a spiral of anxiety and worry, and I think that can get away from us. And so for me, I center myself and say, you know, well, maybe we don't get as much done today. Maybe we have cereal for dinner, like a lot of other families across the country that are just trying to get through a work day when parents work, or you have a single-parent households or two-parent working households. But you have to come back to at the end of the day, the kids are going to react on how you react. You know, MJ is very empathetic, and I think he's developed that moving and knowing how it feels to be the new kid. And so whenever he sees someone who's kind of on the outskirts of a group, I mean, it just makes me so proud. He'll go and try to include them, and I think it is because he knows what it feels like to be on the outside.
Hey, MJ?
Yes, sir?
MJ, does your mom know that you actually like cereal for dinner?
Yes, sir.
You've told her that, so she shouldn't feel bad about that one, right?
No, she shouldn't.
Yeah, and your dad's going to come home in a couple of days. What do you have to show him for all the time he's been gone?
I have a few Lego sets. Mom made a box that we keep our stuff in that we want to show him. We also keep in touch by FaceTime, letters. So when he gets home, we're going to go rubbaging through it.
You know, MJ, you're kind of an expert, and that's why I've got to ask you this question here. So take a breath. My kids, and a lot of kids who don't know about the military but maybe see it in movies and stuff like that, think that it's just totally awesome to have a dad who wears a uniform, who might fly on a fighter plane or go on an aircraft carrier or go off to war and be in these situations where guns are firing and that sort of stuff. It's also hard, too, right, MJ?
Yes. I know other military kids, and when I know them, I'm glad because I know one of our parents or both of our parents are in the military. They'll get, like, you have to let go of your dad.
Now, when all these wars are over, MJ, you think you might design some sort of special unit you could hook your dad up to so that he doesn't go away again?
I've already tried that, and it doesn't work.
Well, MJ, it sounds like you're doing pretty well. Vivian Greentree, how's your son doing, do you think?
He's, you know, given that we moved at the beginning of this school year, I tried to set them up for success by going to meet with the teachers and letting them know that in the middle of the year, their dad would be deploying. So if they saw any signs of distress, you know, that we could attribute it to that and see what we could do to mitigate it. But not every school district understands what it means to be a military child and how the effects of that lifestyle can affect their schoolwork. But I think, you know, our two, we're lucky they have very, very supportive teachers, very supportive principal, and we have the support of our neighbors, which is priceless.
Vivian Greentree is the Director of Research and Policy for Blue Star Families. That's a nonprofit that supports military families. She's also the mother of two, including her 9-year-old son, MJ, who joined us. Vivian's husband and MJ's father, Mike Greentree, is back from his deployment with the Navy this week. Welcome home.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Better living through chemistry. That's a nasty way of talking about the grim innovation of using heavy tranquilizers to drug dates and take advantage of them. It's a serious problem at parties, on college campuses. Date rape, it's called. Of course, you may have heard of the slang term roofies for the various drugs used. Warnings for people to be vigilant can only stop so much of this. Now, one man is fighting innovation with innovation. His company, Drink Savvy, is marketing cups and straws that detect date rape drugs and alert the drinker by changing color. Boston inventor Michael Abramson says necessity was definitely the mother of his invention.
I was at a friend's birthday celebration about 3 or so years ago. I got my first drink of the night from the bar, and you know, a few sips in, it started to feel much more like my 15th. And my friends were able to get me home safely, but you know, waking up feeling as awful as I did and knowing that I had only had a few sips of one drink, I knew that I had been drugged.
Now, without betraying any confidences or making wild accusations, do you know anything about the circumstances? And can you say that your situation is generalized to the many, many other people in the nation that have this kind of experience?
Typically, it is women who are drugged, but men are not immune to it. Certainly, in my case, you know, it could be because either I was a target of being robbed, or it could have been as simple as I got somebody else's drink, so it
right.
was meant for somebody else.
So coming up with a countermeasure involved either a drug that would neutralize any of the available, date rape drugs out there on the market or available for people to use, or you'd have to get some sort of detector. And you chose which modality here?
Yeah, I chose the detection route because it seemed like the simplest and most effective way. If the same cups, straws, and stirrers and glassware that you're drinking from already is also the indicator that would change color if somebody drugs your drink, well, then you've got continuous, effortless, and discreet monitoring of your drink throughout the entire night.
How much enthusiasm is there for this product and even the notion, and I don't know if you've gone here or not, that individual establishments would get a kind of drink savvy, good housekeeping seal of approval, and so that people would understand that if they're in a place that uses this product, they have a different level of safety than they might be somewhere else.
Well, the first thing is to say that everybody should always act as if they did not have a drink-savvy product that they were using. You always have to be vigilant. There's no 100% effective, foolproof anything. So I just want to be clear about that. But the ability to be able to discern which bars and clubs were using the drink-savvy products and which ones were not, certainly I think it would be a little curious to have, if you've got two bars on a street, one is using the drink-savvy products and one isn't. That might be a little curious to the patrons as to, why does this bar care particularly about our safety and this one doesn't.
What's it like being a CEO here?
Again, having been drugged myself, I've got a particularly uniquely invested interest in seeing this succeed and help prevent others from going through similar or worse than what I went through. But it's an exciting process. It's fun, certainly, and I look forward to learning more and more as I go.
What's your next milestone here?
The next milestone is to get the beta out to our crowd funders who successfully helped us raise over $52,000 in about 45 days on Indiegogo. Get the beta out to them by around September of this year, and then get everything ready to be mass-produced and ready for the public at large around the world by early to mid-2014.
Michael Abramson is a patent attorney and the inventor of cups and straws that detect date rape drugs. Amazon CEO Jeffrey Bezos purchased the Washington Post this week for $250 million. Yesterday, we noted that this is the end of an era for the celebrated Graham family, which has owned the Post for nearly a century. Today, we note another chapter in a new era. Alan D. Mutter is a media consultant and former newspaper editor, joins us now. Alan, welcome.
Hello.
So the new era would be, what does a billionaire, internet savvy individual like Jeff Bezos plan to do with the Washington Post? And there have already been some successes online with print publications, but where can Bezos take this, do you think?
Well, of course, we don't know exactly what he's going to do. And he has said publicly anyway that he's not quite sure either. But it seems very clear that the future for most media will be in digital consumption, whether it's radio, newspaper, or television. And I think that Bezos, as the first true digital native to own a newspaper company, I think he's going to take the newspaper in new directions.
And let's separate newspaper from the Washington Post / Washington, D.C. brand. I mean, in some sense, it's really not about a newspaper here. It's about creating a platform for all things Washington that would have Washington Post at the head, but would utilize the Kindle, would utilize other kinds of media platforms. I mean, the world is Bezos's oyster here, it would seem, with Washington as the brand.
Yes. Well, you're absolutely right. When we talk about newspaper, we tend to think about the print artifact. When I talk about a newspaper, I really mean a newspaper company. And that means somebody who has a certain franchise, a certain brand, archives, staffing, relationships with advertisers who make it possible to publish on whatever media platform makes sense for that market. So indeed, the Washington Post of the future, as it is today, really, will be available in probably every conceivable platform, Kindle, iPad, smartphone, smart TV someday soon. So I think that Bezos will definitely be following the thread of where consumers go. And what he knows more than anybody else in the publishing business, he knows a lot about consumers. He knows how they buy, how they sell, how they think. He understands not only where technology is today, but where it's going to go into the future. He certainly understands the behavior of readers on things like Kindles and other mobile devices. So he's going to be able to put together his understanding of consumers and marketers and technology to reconstrue and rethink how a newspaper company behaves in the future. Print probably is part of the equation in the near term. In the long term, maybe not every day of the week, and maybe in the very long term, never at all.
Although people's hunger for political news is unmatched by other platforms of content, it seems to me. I mean, celebrities maybe compete with the politics. You can't do this with the Des Moines Register or the Miami Herald. Bezos would have no interest in those trying to climb into his head here versus Washington, where the interest and the content channel is clear.
Yeah, the Washington Post has a big decision to make about how big its mission is going to be and what it wants to be. On the one hand, it is the predominant metropolitan newspaper in the Washington, D.C. market, the neighboring communities in Virginia and to a certain degree into Maryland. So it behaves like a metro paper like the Des Moines Register or the Boston Globe. On the other hand, as you've noted, it also happens to be the hometown paper of the capital of the free world. And so government politics and all of the big national stories that we tend to think about when we think about Washington, that becomes very fruitful. If they try to serve both masters, be both a terrific local newspaper and also a terrific national, international brand, that is a very big mission. It's possible, but it really requires a deep think about which way they want to push the brand.
Bezos is a deep thinker. He's one click away from the White House. Alan Mutter is a media consultant and a former newspaper editor. Thanks so much, Alan. She was a champion of civil liberties and the First Amendment on ABC News back in 1972.
I don't think anybody should regulate anything. I think it should be up. I don't believe in censorship. I don't believe in anything that they're doing. I think people should have their own rights.
She was a rape victim, an exploited figure of the entertainment world who became a champion of feminism on NBC News in 1979.
The whole idea that people are still making money off of the fact of my being degraded and abused is absolutely phenomenal to me. I mean, I feel now that there's finally human beings that are beginning to stand up and get back their self-respect and make a change in them. You know, I'm not saying ban all pornographic movies or anything like that, but Deep Throat shouldn't be playing because everybody that goes to see it is watching a person being raped and beaten. And that to me isn't right.
But the real Linda Lovelace from the 1970s film Deep Throat, Lovelace, the porn star, the celebrity, the activist, eludes us even today.
Tell me about the person you're playing.
At first, I'm closed up like a flower. And then gradually, the petals start to open. And then I finally learn about myself and I learn how to enjoy sex.
Beautiful.
And I feel free.
That's actress Amanda Seyfried playing Lovelace in the new film of the same name. Directors Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman set out to get closer to the real Linda Lovelace by recreating the deep moral contradictions of the 1970s. Lovelace, they say, became a casualty of the deep contradictions in her own strange life.
Linda's life wasn't all tragic and it wasn't all joy. I mean, that's what life really is. And that's the structure of our movie. It starts out as Linda presented her story to the world, which was through rose-colored glasses. And then 10 years later, she had a very different tale to tell. So that's how we structured the movie, which we felt really mirrors her own psychological development.
Jeffrey, is it also a mirror of a kind of divided notion of the whole porn industry and the whole notion of celebrity that was going on at the same time of Linda Lovelace's career?
And it's still going on. I think it's a reflection of how different reality is from how we perceive it, especially when we're looking at the lives of public people and public events even. You know, the way we receive information and news and life stories and what's really happening often have a wide gulf between them.
Remind us of why, I mean, without being too anatomically correct here, why she was a pioneer in both porn and in cinema. I mean, she changed the culture, not just a few men sitting in the front row with trench coats on, right?
I think a lot of it was her appeal as a person. She was very natural and fun, and she communicated that on camera, and that was really a novelty, especially in in the context of pornography. One of the ways that Deep Throat was a breakthrough was less in the anatomical, but also just in the idea of having a plot, having humor in a pornographic movie, in a feature film.
But Linda herself was really what made the movie such a success because, as Jeffrey said, she was the girl next door. She wasn't the big buxom blonde that was typical of porn stars of that era. She was really just a very average girl next door who became internationally famous for this one movie.
Did that fame give her a power in the industry that no other porn star had or person in the sex trade had?
No, I mean, at that point in time, she was very much a victim to that fame, and she spent the rest of her life trying to overcome it. So as far as she was concerned, that fame just led her to being commodified and exploited, and she spent the rest of her life trying to overcome that.
I think it gave her a platform later on when she wanted to speak out against the industry.
Did it help her make that point, or did it further, you know, send her into obscurity when she seemed to change her tune and become an activist against the sex trade?
Both. She became an activist 10 years after doing Deep Throat, and then at a certain point she just faded into anonymity, partly by choice and also by circumstance. And she also... she was poor. She ended up with no money, and she was a working class woman without an education and had to do menial wage jobs. But where she found her joy and where she really made her life was as a mother, and that's really where she found her delight in her later years.
In this film, do we ironically end up seeing her as a kind of girl next door, mom next door?
I hope we see her as a real person. I think our goal was to try to communicate something real about this person and get behind the superficial image of her, both as a porn star and as a victim and as a feminist spokesperson. I think we wanted to make her a real person. That was our goal.
In the movie, we take the story up to the point where she was psychologically free, where she felt like she had her own voice and had her own power, and then she could move on with her life. So that's where we really end our story.
Could a Linda Lovelace exist today in the online porn world, which is so different from the 1970s?
Yeah, I mean, we're in such a different world now, and that was one of the challenges of the film, was to give the context of what it meant for her to be this first porn superstar in 1973. And you know, she was really the genie that brought pornography into the mainstream unwittingly, and now we're so far further along that continuum where porn is ubiquitous and free and on the internet.
Is that a bad thing? Does this film take a position?
The film does not take a position. We really just try and present the circumstance, and the circumstance for Linda was that she was in a relationship that was domestically violent, so that she equated her relationship to being in porn to the fact that she was in an abusive relationship. But we just present the circumstance of her doing porn and don't take a position on that. As a culture, we all have to decide what it means. I mean, I think every parent has to make that determination, and every kid growing up has to make their own judgments about it.
Finally, what of the Lovelace sort of family legacy? What is her reputation among the people who she was closest to who survived today?
Well, she's remembered with great love by her children, her two grown children, Dominic and Lindsay, who are coming to our premiere, who saw the film at Sundance and are very supportive of it. And one of the things that was really moving to us was after we showed the film to them, Lindsay, Linda's daughter, told us that each of them have long-term partners that they've never been able to really communicate their mother's story to, and they've tried to read the books, and they're just too graphic and awful. And she felt that now with this film, they'd be able to make their partners understand something about their mother and the world she came from. And that felt great.
I think the bottom line for us was to do a film about this woman, this character, who all her life felt that she was exploited, and that we wanted to do a film that gave her her humanity.
Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman are the co-directors of the new movie Lovelace. And after we spoke with Rob and Jeff, we learned that the film company Arrow Productions, which owns the rights to the original Deep Throat movie, has taken legal action to block the movie Lovelace for copyright infringement. So it's not exactly world peace we've achieved here, but obesity rates among preschoolers are falling in many states for the first time in decades, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says. Declines in obesity among low-income preschoolers found in 18 states in the U.S. Virgin Islands from 2008 to 2011. CDC Director Thomas Frieden said yesterday that this is the first report to show many states with declining rates of obesity in our youngest children after literally decades of rising rates. It must be all that organic produce and healthy, high-fiber, unprocessed chow, right? Or could it be that fast food has changed from the greasy this?
It's big, it's beefy, it's the grilled stuffed burrito from Taco Bell.
To the healthy sounding this.
The latest new McCafe Blueberry Pomegranate Smoothie. Sweet blueberries, raspberries, and a splash of pomegranate juice.
Pomegranate juice. Wonderful. This one's cover issue for the Atlantic magazine. It's all about fast food. Reporter David Friedman joins us. David, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So your fast food cover coincides with this CDC report on declining obesity rates. Could fast food actually have something to do with it? You make that argument.
Well, I think it might a little bit. We have a long way to go, both in fast food and in obesity rates. I don't think we can rest because we see a little bit of decline here. We still have an enormous problem. Obesity is rapidly becoming the biggest killer of humanity, and we got a lot of work to do in fast food and elsewhere.
How do processed foods actually, at least with a rational look at processed foods and utilizing them as a component in a balanced diet, how can that fight obesity?
Well, in any kind of food, processed or unprocessed, one of the things we want to do is reduce fat. We want to reduce sugar. Let's get rid of what I call problem carbs, the simple carbs, the refined carbs, the starch. And that's true whether you're talking about an organic blueberry pie or whether you're talking about a Big Mac. So the problem is most people who have a weight problem tend to be heavy on the processed food, less so on the unprocessed food. So what I argue is we shouldn't just be telling people to eat fruits and vegetables. We should be saying let's get healthier processed food.
And how do you do that? What would that mean, and how does eating organic choices and healthy sort of fresh unprocessed choices miss what could be achieved if we modified processed food?
To get processed food healthier, we basically know what to do, and we've done it before. There are all kinds of ways of lowering fat and sugar in processed foods while, and this is critical, while retaining a lot of their appeal. I mean, there's a reason people eat processed food. It pushes all our neurological buttons. It's cheap. It's convenient. So if we're going to lower the fat and we're going to lower the sugar in ways that people will keep eating it, we better do it so that we keep pushing those buttons, or else people will just flip to processed food that has crap in it. So that's really the trick. Now, the other thing to understand here is just because you're eating unprocessed food doesn't mean you're eating food that's going to help you with your weight. If it's high in fat, if it's high in sugar, as many unprocessed foods are, you're going to have exactly the same problems.
One of the things that's interesting in the argument that you make is that, you know, the success that the processed food industry has had in pressing these kind of brainstem buttons is actually a doorway, an incentive pathway for getting people to do things healthier. If you can press those buttons with processed food but deliver a healthy product, you actually might have more bang for your buck than the sort of hold your nose and eat a piece of celery approach in the organic aisle.
It makes an incredible amount of sense. It's something that most scientists, food scientists, nutritionists agree with completely, which is we talk about the processed food industry as being evil geniuses of designing food, of engineering food, and of marketing it. Well, sure, of course they are. They're the best in the world at this stuff. Let's use that. They know how to do it. And by the way, they're ready to do it and willing to do it if we'll give them credit for it. Let's push them to go ahead and do this, reward them for doing it, and they will absolutely produce healthier food that will help with the obesity crisis.
David Friedman is a contributing editor for The Atlantic. And now let me just to get into the backstory here, David, do you mind?
Sure.
You hate foodies, right? You have friends that are foodies. They annoy you. They really make you mad. And so that's why you went down this road here.
I'm a foodie. I eat pretty much just the way Michael Pollan says I should. I eat vegetables like they're candy. I eat in a very, very healthy way. I would like to see everybody eat this way. I think it's the best way to control weight. The problem is right now that it's not the way people who have weight problems are eating. And we don't know how yet to switch them to eating unprocessed foods. The problem with the unprocessed food movement, the foodies, the Michael Pollanites, that really does, in fact, upset me and disturb me and make me very angry, is that they say it's the only solution and that we must make all processed food go away. The only way is to get everybody eating unprocessed food. Not going to happen. The people, many people can't afford that food. They can't access it and they don't like it. And it's just not realistic to say that's the only solution.
So it's kind of a design solution you're talking about here. Are the food giants, is the food industry, the fast food industry, the processed food industry, interested in a design approach that maintains the processing but delivers a healthier end product?
Absolutely. The processed food industry wants one thing, profits. Now, that's often said in a way that means it's synonymous with evil. That's not true. If they can profit from doing good, they will. The problem right now is if they make their food healthier, they get knocked for it. Right away, the healthy food movement will come right in and say, well, this is just a token effort. They're just disguising all their crap. They're just trying to make us sick by using this in a switch and bait and switch way. And we have to stop doing that. We have to start giving them credit when they actually do the right things, which they often do, by the way.
And they're basically operating from a position of power because they do have the attention of so many people with a weight problem. You've ever had a weight problem, David?
I have, yes, absolutely. And in fact, you'll find most people who take an interest in writing about this have at some point had a weight problem.
And I know you said that you eat vegetables like they're candy. I mean, I don't want to hear about how, you know, your guilty pleasure is like rhubarb or something. You're not going to tell me that, right?
Not if you don't want to hear it, I won't tell you that. But
what is the guilty food for you?
Oh, well, the guilty food would be a great burger. I mean, I love that stuff. I have the same weaknesses and probably more so than most people do. So I'm a foodie that has gotten to be a foodie over a long period of time, making slow, gradual changes. And that's the way you have to do it. People generally aren't going to leap from eating crap to eating healthy food overnight. And to try to push people to doing that is largely been proven to be a waste of time. So let's guide people towards it. Start off with healthier junk food and then move them eventually towards a Michael Pollan kind of solution.
All right. David Friedman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Friedman is a contributing editor for The Atlantic, making the argument that the processed food industry is a pathway, a design pathway towards healthier food and lower obesity rates. For David Friedman, the guilty pleasure is the burger, even a redesigned burger. For Sean out there in Cincinnati, it's...
My fast food guilty pleasure is the McDonald's cheeseburger Happy Meal. Brings me back to a moment of childhood before I recognized that Mickey D's was bad for you.
Many of you talked about McDonald's as you shared your stories of what fast food makes you happy. What is that brainstem button that is actually a way of getting your attention? Nikki from Bloomfield, New Jersey.
My fast food guilty pleasure is always a McDonald's French fries and a Coke. After a night on the town, it somehow makes me feel so much better almost instantly. And no, the irony of this is not entirely lost on me.
Not all of you indulge your guilty pleasures, though. A listener in Jacksboro, Texas said, haven't had fast food in years, being a big guy my whole life. In 2006, I lost over 100 pounds, never looked back. Swearing off fast food might be the best decision I ever made. Masuma from New York says, I love hot wings and pizza, even though I don't want to eat so much, but it has to be halal. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And happy end of Ramadan to so many of you. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.